Previously on Lost.
Do you really think all this is an accident? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, Jeff?
Morse?
Subway, do you know who I am? I'm one of the Oceanic Six!
You gotta find me, John. You gotta find me. And when you do, you'll find him.
Who?
Jacob.
I think we did the right thing, Jack. I think he wants us to come back.
Two players. Two sides. One is light. One is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back! We have to go back! We have to go back! We have to go back!
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast for Season 4, Episode 1, the beginning of the end. It's time to choose. Are you Camp Jack, Camp Locke, or Camp Bernard and Rose? My name's Dave Gonzalez, and you know me, I'm going hard for Camp Locke. I don't think the best intentions are necessarily at play, but if I've learned anything from 2020, the bad guys win, so I'm going.
You just like snuck an antagonist check in there. I don't like it. My name is Joanna Robinson, and if I have to pick between these three options, I'm clearly going with Bernard and Rose, not just because I want to get some dental work done while I'm on the island.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I guess just to be the cool kid who's not the same as everyone else, I'm going Camp Jack also because I probably would still be the guy who wants to get off the island. I know that everyone else on this island has forgotten about wanting to leave except for Jin and Sun at this point, and apparently Jack. So I would probably follow Jack, which, you know, questionable at best.
It's questionable in the island storyline, but it seems like you at least have Hurley on your side because
we're
in Season 4, which means flash forwards. It's going to be great. If this is your first time joining us, welcome. This podcast is an ideal companion if you're rewatching Lost with us or visiting the island for the very first time because each episode comes in sections for your listening pleasure. First, a calm section that only discusses the preceding episodes and avoids all spoilers, and a second section called The Storm. It's a storm of spoilers discussing this week's episode in the context of the entire series and over a decade of Lost fandom. Storm's going to get real interesting as we're in the back half here of Lost because it is the beginning of the end. If you would like to support the show as we go all the way to the end, you can go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers, and there you also get access to bonus content. So you're not only supporting us by subscribing monthly, you are getting bonus stuff. You're getting extra podcasts, you're getting access to our Slack, you're getting posts of various content. I put up one of the short films I made in high school last week, just as a lark. It's been super fun, and Joanna is working overtime with two extra podcasts for your listening pleasure, depending on what level you subscribe. Joanna, we got some spooky things and a musical from my past and your present.
It's also, that movie musical is also spooky. The Angel of Death comes a calling in that musical. Anyway, yeah, and if you haven't watched that video from Dave, I don't mean to be a creep about it, but like, you should watch that video that Dave posted.
There's quite a lot to unpack with that video.
Yes.
So if you need something to do.
Yes. Neil and I both were, I don't know how to describe it. Okay.
Fully supportive of him posting that on the internet.
Fully supportive of him putting that on the internet forever. Okay. So two bonus podcasts this week. One is Feels Like the First Time, where Kristen, if you've ever want to hear me lose my mind, please listen to me completely deprived of any and all sleep. In fact, I might have fallen asleep during that podcast recording on the mic, but don't tell anyone. talking to Kristen about Halloween, we did a Feels Like the First Time Spooky Scream edition, and we'll be watching four Halloween-themed movies. We're watching Nightmare on Elm Street 3, which is, I think, the one that Dave called. Thank you.
No. I thought you were going to do two.
No, we're doing Dream Warriors.
You're doing a better one. Okay. It's just not the one I would consider the gay one, which
curveball
from Kristen.
Don't worry, I brought the gay. So, okay. So we're doing Nightmare on Elm Street, Dream Warrior. We're doing a classic that both of us have seen that Kristen insisted on, which is Hocus Pocus. We're doing a classic both of us have seen that I insisted on, which is The Craft. And then we are doing a movie that I was shocked to find out that Kristen had never seen, which is The Babadook. So we're gonna do The Babadook. Gay icon, The Babadook, which is a real like downer of a tone. So don't worry, we're gonna stick it in the middle somewhere and end, I think, with Hocus Pocus. So you can find out the complete live watch schedule of that. That's available to anyone who's in our Patreon. There's like a shared Slack we have with Buffering folks. And so if you go to our website, stormpodcast.com, all of the live watch, the Halloween live watches are on there. And then Dave Chen and I decided to talk about Prince of Egypt, which I had just watched for the first time myself, and Dave loved, and we disagreed on whether or not it's incredibly good. So have fun listening to us talk about that. So that's available for our $10 subscribers. So there's a Feels Like the First Time for all of our subscribers, a Chen Pop, as we're calling it, or Gen Pop for our $10 subscribers, waiting for you in your Patreon. There's also, you can go to stormpodcast.com to find out the latest of what we're doing. We're doing a live watch of Over the Garden Wall in our Patreon Slack, which is a fun fall favorite of Dave and mine and Neil has never seen. So we're going to watch that on the 18th. So that's going to be really fun. We're going to watch another secret movie club movie at the end of the month that I have picked and not revealed yet. So stay tuned for that reveal. You can email us, host@stormpodcast.com, if you want to get in touch with us. We've got a few good emails this week. And you can also leave us a review, which is like a really nice thing for you to do. And I'm going to read this one from May of Green Gables from Australia. And she spelled Gables, GAY-BLES. So I'm really, thanks for that. Joy, may I appreciate it. 5 stars, a joy. She says, hello from Brisbane, Australia. And she did request the accent, or she said I could do something else. So I will not be doing the accent. You will find out what I will be doing instead at the end of this review. May writes, I just want to say I love this podcast so much, and it's pretty much one of the only things I listen to, even when I have zero time. I listen as soon as it comes. I love the format. It completely made me recalibrate my feelings about spoilers, execution. But by far, it's all about the hosts. I just love the hosts. They balance everything so well. They're knowledgeable without being dull or condescending, critical while still being so in love with the shows, and total horn dogs who are still very respectful. Thank you. I love being a respectful horn dog, man.
That's the first time I've ever been called that.
Dave, your storm thoughts give me life. Neil, you are so thoughtful about cinema and life. Joanna, I've been stalking all of your work online for ages, but your powers combined, chef's kiss. I didn't fall out of love with Lost, but I can honestly say this pod, these hosts, and I'll just put the spark back in the relationship. I love this stupid, sexy show and hearing you all, everybody, talk about it week to week. Also, I ran out of off-season tour pods and have literally gone back and started listening to all the Game of Thrones episode. And I can honestly say the pods are so great. I almost want to watch Game of Thrones again. Almost. Love your work. Don't fall down. And then she said, P.S. The accents bring me joy. You're welcome to read this podcast and this review in an Australian accent if you dare. If not, please just ask Dave to say 4 billion beans. Dave?
4 billion beans!
Nailed it. Right. Thank you. Now, as for our emails, we got a couple really fun ones. We got a lot to talk about because this is a season premiere. So we have a lot of like season context to talk about. So I will try not to dwell too long here. But I really liked a bunch of the emails we got this week. So we will zip through a few of them. This first one comes from Melissa, who is there at every live watch. She's a commie, a first time watcher. I'm a big fan of like watching how Melissa reacts to things. So anyway, Melissa writes, on the pod this week, Joanna and Jen talked about how first time watchers probably weren't going to go into the season finale season three finale without some level of knowledge of we have to go back and how that might taint the experience. I'm just one data point, but I'd never seen that Jack gif until the finale, and the first time I heard we have to go back was in the pod intro. I had no idea until Kate showed up that the flashback was a flash forward, and I was actually a little confused and thought it was somehow a flashback still, and Kate and Jack knew each other in the past, but had been keeping it a secret on island the whole time, which made me think a bit. If someone had a feels like the first time podcast with me before I started watching Lost, what would I have known? So here's a list of what Melissa would have known about Lost if we caught her before it premiered. Melissa writes, there are characters named Jack, Sawyer, and Kate, and they gave my 8th grade classmate a lot of angst when the show originally aired. There is a character named Desmond because one of my coworkers named his son after his favorite Lost character. There was a theory that the island was purgatory. The show has a quote-unquote bad ending. The show ends, I think, with a shot of someone's eye. Maybe because a character in This Is 40 watches the finale of Lost, and we see that on her laptop. Maybe you'll have to bleep that part. I don't think so. I think that's fine. I think it's fine to say Lost ends on the shot of someone's eye.
The reflection of them watching it on a laptop, streaming it on Netflix. That's everyone's like, this is dumb. This would never happen. And now we're doing a whole rewatch podcast because they figured it out.
Melissa concludes by saying, not sure how I managed to get through this many years without being Lost spoiled. I do wonder if Lost aired today and had a ton of gifts made of it like Schitt's Creek, would I be as unsullied? Maybe, maybe not. I didn't know the twist at the end of Psycho until 3 years ago when I watched it the first time, so maybe I have a superpower. I'd be curious to hear what other commies knew ahead of watching the show. Might be a fun prompt. Thanks for reading this and being great hosts. Yeah, if any other commies want to write in and say like what they knew, I think that is a really fun thing to hear from people.
It's also fun making our own memes as we go along. I'm learning that did not exist apart from the original Lost fandom. So I'm very happy with that. Melissa can join us on this.
Horse. Okay. Horse. We got a couple emails about Charlie's skills on the keypad, and a bunch of people pointed out that our listeners and we were wondering, like, how did Charlie know which section of Good Vibrations to do? How did he know how to do it on his first try? A bunch of people pointed out that as she was dying, blonde underwater lesbian Bonnie told Charlie at least the first few numbers of the sequence. So he had like the first few numbers to work off of. And so once he's doing that, he's like, oh, I know how it goes from here, sort of thing. Yeah. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Does that work for you guys?
Yeah, I remember Bonnie, because she starts telling him and then she's going way too fast and dying at the same time. So,
And then one of our listeners, Matthew, wrote in and said that, he remembers, I was saying that like, I can still sing my phone number from when I was a kid. He was saying that he and his friends used to pass around sheet music for touchstone phones and like play music on their phones.
Wow.
I was like, that's really fun. So let's just assume that Charlie did that as well. So his last email is from Grace, who is responding to one of our other guests, Wai Chen Bui, who said in last week's episode that everything in Lost is governed by destiny and the characters have no free will. I'm not sure this is exactly what she said, but it's similar enough that I think this is, you know, the response here is definitely warranted, and Grace had a lot of thoughts on it. So Grace writes, it got me thinking about another common Damon Lindelof theme, the inevitability of death. This idea is all over Lindelof's work, although perhaps most obviously in The Leftovers. Sometimes death is predictable and foreseen, as in terminal illness, old age, or life marked by risk. Sometimes death is random, inexplicable, and shocking. Either way, death is coming for us. We can't outrun it. So what do we do about that fact? Obviously, Lost is a show that is interested in destiny on a cosmic level, the way that certain lives are meant to be collide with our own. But I've always understood Lost as a show about two particular timelines of grief, the certainty of Lost in the future, and about the difficulty of completely moving beyond Lost or trauma in the past. The characters are all stuck in the scrap of time between those two things, and they have to decide what to do with that time. If fate is the moment when our clock runs out, then free will is the span of time preceding it. We see that question play out in a lot of ways in Lost. Some people, like Charlie or Rose, and that's not a spoiler about Rose because that's just about Rose's terminal illness, are lucky enough to make their peace or settle their accounts before the end. But oftentimes the characters use their remaining time imperfectly, prioritizing the wrong things or wasting time on things that don't matter. Some accounts are never settled. This is clearly a factor in Lost's bad parents carousel, where children continually want a final conversation that validates what they've experienced. They almost never get that validation. I think that's what we see in Jack and Kate, Sawyer, Locke, Saeed, etc., struggling toward how to move past the loop of their own traumas and make different choices with the time left to them. In other words, it's not that characters on Lost have no free will. Yes, they all have metaphorical swords hanging over their necks, but their choices and their connections to each other are very real. They have to be for any of this to matter. Everything that happened, happened. And if we believe Desmond's rule of destiny, you can't change death, but details can vary. There's a similar scenario in Watchmen. Two characters know that they will have 10 years together, and they know they will be happy. They also know it will end in tragedy, but the characters don't know what happens during those 10 years. And it's that decade, which exists outside of destiny or omniscience, that ultimately matters more than its end. Death is inevitable, but in the interim exist all the choices that make up our relationships with each other, which is arguably what loss is all about. Sorry for the extremely long email, and thank you for being such a lovely presence in my ears these past few years, and especially during this pandemic. Lost was the show that made me fall in love with television, and it's been wonderful revisiting it week to week. Sincerely, Grace. So.
Nice.
There you go. I love this email from Grace. Do you guys have anything to add or any thoughts on it?
I think that's how we move through time, so I really like it. Like, the inevitability of death is basically like the inevitability of the end of everything. Everything ends, like she's saying. And, like, not only is it free will, but the interesting thing about being fourth dimensional in the particular way that we are is we get to live all these little moments and make our own narratives around it, which, if anything, is a blessing of not being more fourth dimensional. But thanks for galaxy braining me, Grace. I'm off in a whole different thing now.
Neil, do you have anything you want to add to Grace's email?
Yeah, no, I mean, this is one of the things that I like about Lost, is that it allows us to sort of get into this, because, you know, Grace brings up the parents and the constant seeking of some sort of closure for our characters. And we even get situations like with Sawyer where he sort of does get closure on one of his demons, and it doesn't seem to be everything he wanted it to be.
Right.
So I think I love the, you know, one of the things we love about Lost is the layers, you know, and yeah, I like it. It's great. It's good stuff all around.
Excellent. So the last thing that I'm going to say here in my little section of the preamble is that this weekend we are watching in our Patreon Slack season four, episode 2, Confirmed Dead, with one Neil Miller as your host. So we will find out who is confirmed dead, or will we? Until then, Neil,
I bet we find out who's in that coffin, right?
I'm sure, in episode 2, absolutely. Neil, what happened on Lost this week?
Well, we talked about the fact that we're all speeding toward an end, but every end needs a beginning, and this episode is the beginning of the end. And it was directed by the aforementioned painting haver, we were talking about that before, Jack Bender. Is written by Carlton.
Oh, we talked about that off air, so just so you guys know.
No, that's a flash forward in this episode.
Okay. Yeah,
we'll get there.
The podcast does flash forwards now.
Anyway, it was written by Carlton Cuse and Damon Lindelof. You know them. It aired on January 31st, 2008, and it takes place on day 91 on the island. In the flash forward, we check in with how Hurley's been doing since getting off the island. Apparently he made it. He gets arrested. He requests to be put back into the mental health facility where he was before. He takes a meeting with a mysterious man named Matthew Abaddon. He has a conversation with Ghost Charlie, and then handily beats Jack in a game of horse.
Horse?
he's fine. This is fine. Everything's fine. Back at the beach camp on the island, Desmond returns to break the bad news about Charlie and not Penny's boat. As they head out into the jungle to tell the rest of the group, Hurley falls behind a little bit and sees the cabin, which disappears just as John Locke arrives. Nothing weird happening there. Everyone eventually rendezvous back at the site of the Flight 815 cockpit, where, if you'll remember, Greg Grunberg died in the first episode.
The pilot died in the pilot?
Yeah, the pilot died in the pilot. A big island union meeting ensues, with John Locke arguing that they should go back to Dharmaville and hide and protect themselves from what's coming with the freighter. And despite learning of Charlie's warning, Jack continues to argue that the freighter is still their best chance to be rescued. And thus, our group of survivors is divided. Hurley, Claire, Rousseau, Alex, Ben, Carl, you remember Carl, and a few nameless other survivors go with John Locke. Everyone else heads back to the beach with Jack, with the notable exception of Bernard and Rose, who don't seem to want to hang out with anybody anymore. It's a decision that, as we learn from the flash forward, Hurley would later regret disagreeing with Jack. The whole thing ends with someone new parachuting onto the island. It's Jeremy Davies, and he's looking for Jack. Very exciting.
Yay!
Fun fact, fans of the show, when this was originally airing, had to wait 8 months and 8 days between the season 3 finale and the season 4 premiere, which, if I remember correctly, was terrible. It was awful to have to wait that long for more Lost.
That's especially after that
season
baby.
3 finale. Yeah, okay. It's many, many months. This week's opening question, as we see, is this rendezvous back at the cockpit takes place. Everybody's hugging each other. A lot of people seeing each other for the first time since, you know, like a day ago. Juliet, as Joanna pointed out as we were preparing to record, chooses to hug Alex first, which is very funny. So the question is, aside from Hurley, because we all want to hug Hurley after this episode, which of the Losties would you hug first if you were at the reunion? Let's start with Joanna.
As a respectful horn dog, as our listener review pointed out, I'm going to go with Saeed, whose arms were looking particularly inviting and glowing in the torchlight. So it's a Saeed hug for me.
Saeed hug. There you go. Dave, whom are you wrapping your arms around?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, because I guess I'm going to try not to assume what my pre-existing relationship, like, because I'm Dave on the island, he of the Monkey Hotel and little else.
Sure. Yeah.
So
I genuinely at this point don't remember where the Monkey Hotel bit started. I know it's a bit now. I just don't remember the
origin. Always been here. Okay. But I'm going to have to go with Carl. I feel like Carl had a rough go of it. And yeah, he's with Alex again, but like he saved us all from the others' attack prematurely. So, hey, Carl. What's up?
Yeah, Carl's had a rough time. I'm choosing Sawyer because you could just... I don't know, maybe I'm on the other side of this and I can just tell that Sawyer just went through a very vulnerable moment of trying to be nice to Hurley and like trying to help him talk through the loss of Charlie. And I'm just like, you know, Sawyer maybe needs a hug at this point because he tried to do some therapy and it didn't go well.
Killed his dad killed his... At the apex of his entire life a couple of hours ago.
It just occurred to me that like one of us should probably have hugged Claire. Oh, well.
well, Hurley hugs Claire.
Yeah, Hurley's got it. Okay.
I think if we were told if Hurley was off the table, we could assume that he took care of Claire, right?
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. I love that Alex and Juliet hug. It's really hilarious. Please go back and watch it if you want, because they're just like acting like they're best friends when like I know they're both others, but like that's just not really the context of their relationship. Number two on my list, I'm glad you brought up Carl, Neil. Number two on my list of like curious interactions in this episode is that Carl and Alex just have a little picnic at one point.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty great.
Like
they look like they're having a great time.
Naomi's
too.
Lying dead on the ground with a knife in her back, and Carl and Alex are like, picnic time? Yeah, picnic time. Sounds great. I love it. I do want to do a quick point of order. I know it was like the premise of our opening prompt. I just didn't understand that Anyway, I believe Rose and Bernard go with Team Jack to the beach. They don't go off on their own. So
those just, sons of bitches.
They just choose Jack because Rose is like, whatever's not John, that's where I'm going. Jack it is.
I wanted to point that out as something, and maybe this is a way to sort of talk about like the greater aspect of season four. But because of like some production reasons, making their planned story they want to tell over season four get a little truncated, this season has a lot of teams, and who's on whose team and where are the teams. So I just wanted to put a big old flag in the team split up there at the top. But you are correct, I suppose. There's really only two teams, even though, you know, there's an emotional team.
Yeah, like emotionally, Rose and Bernard are sort of...
Oh,
they're
going to
go with Jack, but they're not going to leave. They're not going to leave the island.
Yeah.
Right. They've already made that very clear.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
So we got, team going to the barracks. We got a team going to try to get off the island. And we have Rose and Bernard who are going to stay with their friends to stay safe.
They're
going to
wave from the beach. They're going to wave goodbye to everyone.
Wherever the rescue copter is, they're going to be like, we're fine, goodbye. And take down the SOS and whatnot. But yeah, one of the reasons that the season was shortened, or the main reason the season was shortened, is this took place, the production of this season took place during the 2007-2008 writer's strike. That happened in between November 2007 and February 2008. As you heard Neil mention, this episode aired
January.
And so this is still in the time period where the writer strike is taking place. There won't be an official podcast check-in this week because Carlton Cuse was not only was the show supporting the writer strike, but Carlton Cuse was one of the representatives negotiating on behalf of the WGA, the DGA, and the SAG. Because of like old entertainment history, the writers' contracts went up before all the other, the Directors Guild and the Screen Actors Guild contracts went up. And so they were the first ones to have this opening to renegotiate things like residuals for streaming episodes and downloads. Because as you might have remembered, we talked about Lost as one of the really early iTunes shows that you could just like download to your iPod. And, you know, you have different like podcasts the executive producers are on. And eventually, because it's ABC, someone has to figure out how people are getting paid for all of these things. And the writers, because Lost was so early on the downloading bandwagon, that's why Carlton Cuse was so involved in negotiations. But at the time the season started, they only had 8 episodes of the season done of a planned 16. And as the writers' strike finally ended in the middle of the season, they were able to go back and produce more episodes, which we'll cover when we get there. But that's sort of the idea of how this season, which was supposed to be, you know, the season that they were able to do everything they wanted because finally ABC told them they could end the show with this many episodes. They kind of get thrown off and have to improv like jazz, like Lost does, to get their story through to the end.
Yeah, we'll talk about we have a pretty healthy storm section this week, and we'll talk a little bit more about the specific structure of the season and how it impacts it. But they had, 8 episodes in the can. And then they had to take another long break, and then they came back with 5 more. So we'll talk about that and what they had planned to do in the storm.
Anyway, we are back in the first episode, this episode, the beginning of the end, which doesn't start on a shot of somebody's eye, as we mentioned in our email section. Big theme from Lost, eyes, but not this time. And not only that, but they kind of do like this fake out to, we got a pile of exotic looking fruit, but it's not on the island. Hurley's driving his Camaro through it, indicating this is also the first season premiere that is not Jack-centric. Even though Jack does appear in this episode, it's a Hurley episode, and it brings a ton of our cast together back at the cockpit on the island. while establishing some mysteries of season four. I think this is a really effective episode. While rewatching it, do either of you have any memories of if this played as effective to people who waited for 8 months to get answers to questions that they only got more questions?
I don't know that they only got more questions, but I think that I was doing a lot of work, reading through recaps and message boards and comment sections at the time, and everyone seemed pretty jazzed on this. Like, the ratings are down for season four, and in fact, I believe the lowest rated Lost episode is in season four. So the ratings are still down.
Mm-hmm. This is the highest rated episode of the entire season.
Right. So maybe that indicates that some people are frustrated, but but I think that a lot of people responded really well to this not being like a, as is often the case with the season premieres on Lost, let's focus in on, you know, what these three characters are doing or what these two characters are doing. It's a let's check in with everyone episode, as you mentioned, Dave. And I think that that's really effective. I think the only people who really get the short shrift are Sun and Jin. And we get a nice little like, oh, hi. We love when Sun and Jin are reunited moment, but like mostly they don't have a lot to do, but everyone else kind of does. And that's pretty great. And so I think it was like a pretty popular episode. And like what it does amongst those who are like into Lost, and what it does do at least, is instead of being like mysteries, 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 it's like setting up a really, really clear, definable mystery of the season four. Which is who are the Oceanic Six, and for the people who did get off the island, how the heck did they get off the island? Mm-hmm. So we'll be following that week to week as it unfurls. But I think concentrating it into that question and making that question in true Damon Lindelof fashion, the answer being people. I'm into it. Like I'm very like defensive of season four. Not that it needs defending from me, but like it's one of my favorite seasons, probably because it's so short and because the mystery is so like clearly defined and yes, answered. Like I feel like it's okay to tell you guys that yes, like you will get answers this season, but they set it up as sort of like a call and response from the first half of the season and the second half of the season. So yeah.
That sounds like a good time to introduce a new corner, new season, new corners. Joanna, what would you like our commies to write in about as we progress through season four?
Well, some of them are doing it a little bit in our Patreon Slack already. Our listener Shruti has like created this master document of commie theories with like graphs and pie charts and stuff like that. It's really fun. Like, who is he and who is in the coffin and all this sort of stuff like that. But I think we want to do a running Who Are the Oceanic Six segment on the show until we find out the answer. So let's just run down really quickly what we know. Basically, like Oceanic Six detectives, please write in to us, hosts@stormpodcast.com. If you're watching for the first time, you have some thoughts and theories. I think what we know in this episode is that we can add Hurley to the list of people who got off the island. Yes.
Well, he also yells, I'm one of the Oceanic Six. So if we could start anywhere.
So we've got Jack, Kate, and Hurley. That's half the Oceanic Six there.
I think we put Kate on the maybe.
Okay.
Because here's the thing. Nobody else has seen Kate except for Jack.
Oh.
Okay.
Nobody else has referenced
Ghost Kate.
I mean, look, this episode has Charlie appearing off the island, granted to Hurley, but to like what we understand as a... So, like, this episode's really interesting because it does, like, a reverse of what Hurley's storyline is for the first half of the series, where it's like, oh, man, it looks like he's crazy, but no, he's all right, and he's actually, like, this really great guy. And here it goes. The episode starts with the cannonball, but then we flash forward to the future, and he's like, oh, man, he's unhappy again and, like, wants to go into the mental institution for some reason and may actually be being tracked by Lance Reddick from The Wire. So it's interesting that Charlie shows up and says he is dead, but also says he is really there. And, you know, we also saw Jack referencing his dad and then meeting Kate, and those are the only two people. I don't know that we could put Kate solidly
okay,
in the Oceanic
great.
Six.
We know that Jack and Hurley are two of the, we have 1/3 of the Oceanic Six nailed down. I guess if we want to add Kate as a question mark, then we also probably have to add the he mm-hmm. that Kate referenced as another mark on our list of mm-hmm. clues, unless
which
we think
is obviously
he,
the horse.
Unless we think her he is Hurley, which aww. It might be. And then another, like, here's what I love about this season. It's really fun to watch how they continually shuffle the deck on the islands, because like what we have right now is we've got two camps that have separated, but we've got at least two of the Oceanic Six, Jack and Hurley, going off in different directions. So whoever it is, they do get off the island at some point. It's like watch the ball under the cup as it moves right. in this game of season four. You know, Jack and Hurley get off the island. So you can't just say like, oh, clearly the Oceanic Six is just comprised of beach people or barrack people, because we like don't know yet how or who or where they're going to get off. Does that make sense? So what else? Do we have any other clues?
It could even be John Locke, who in this episode gets a gun pulled on him by Jack, and Jack tries to shoot him.
It could. It could be anyone.
It could be the polar opposites.
Are there any? And then the other thing we do know, this isn't tied specifically to the Oceanic Six, but something that we do know is that they're lying. Like Kate and Jack had this discussion at the end, or Ghost Kate and Jack had this discussion at the end of the season three finale, but it's reiterated by Hurley, which is that they're lying about something. We don't know exactly what. We do know that Hurley lies about not having met Ana Lucia. So there is, you know, they're lying, they're covering something. What are they covering and why? You know, we don't know.
And somebody might know if we believe Hurley's perspective, because they're asked, are they still alive?
You know who might notice if Kate were gone when they're off the island and might be very concerned about Kate not being there?
Nathan Fillion?
No. Vincent.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Vincent would definitely notice if Kate left the house to go hang out with Jack.
Oh, yeah. Throwing so the Vincent to the Navy. Could be a one.
I have to get back. I have to feed him. Is that what you're right. saying? Like, mm-hmm. yeah.
We're making the assumption that the Oceanic Six are people, but what Neil is saying...
presupposing.
What Neil presupposes.
You're saying keep all of your eyes open.
So that's the Oceanic Six mystery. And that, I mean, like, ties into something else I wanted to say about... So, you know, we've been getting increasingly on Lost this whole, like, whoa, so-and-so knew so-and-so in a flashback. And, we, you know, and, like, sometimes it's incredibly effective. Like, I think Sawyer meeting Christian Shepherd in a bar. And sometimes it just feels like a little bit of overkill where you're like, does it matter that Charlie saved Nadia in an alley and not some random woman? I don't know. But in this episode, we get Mike. I call him Uncle Mike because he's literally my friend's uncle. The actor who plays Ana Lucia's partner. I call him Uncle Mike.
How did we get through the Ana Lucia episode and this is where this fact comes out?
I'm sorry I didn't tell you earlier. Uncle Mike, who has been on The Walking Dead and Southland Tales and a bunch of other stuff. But anyway, Uncle Mike Cudlitz. Like, he's not just there to be like, whoa, what a crazy coincidence. He, like, him being there gives us information, which is that that Hurley is lying about having met Ana Lucia or not. You know what I mean? So, that makes it feel more important than, because, like, you're like, why couldn't it have just been a rando cop? Well, like, a rando cop wouldn't have made that Ana Lucia connection for us, so, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The flash forwards this season as a mystery is where they're going to be having some fun with you. For instance, Neil, would you like to explain how H and O are a recurring theme in this episode?
Yeah, we get, well, and it was fun because you pointed this out in the live watch that we were doing in the Slack for people to sort of notice every time H and O come up, because H, as you know, because everybody knows the soft top of their head, is the eighth letter of the alphabet, and O is the 15th. So it's a 8:15 everywhere. And so our flight 8:15, you get the horse game. You get the one, the fun one is in the scene where Hurley meets with Matthew Abaddon, Lance Reddick, and then sort of flips out and is like, get this guy away from me. Behind him, on like, there's like somebody built with like little like science children's toys, an H and an O.
No way.
And it's behind him. There's another one. Great. What's the one that I'm forgetting? There's the basketball one.
Oh,
he sees Charlie in front of the ho-hos.
Ho-hos, yeah. Yes. Yeah. He sees Charlie in front of the ho-hos. So lots of it's a fun way for the show structurally, I think. And they do this. They did this with the opening, as we've discussed, where they're sort of taking the structural things and sort of moving them around a little bit or tweaking them a little bit or flipping it a little bit. And so the numbers pop up in unexpected ways, I would say.
They're letters instead of numbers.
Right, yep. But they're letters that represent the numbers.
Yeah.
But it has the interesting effect where there are times in this episode, and I think later on in this season, where the off-island stuff feels like the jungle of mystery, and everything that's on the island seems very based on physical things, I understand. But we'll see, like, moving forward, whether or not they're able to keep this very clean divide of on-island mission and off-island mystery, or if it gets a little bit more complex. Joanne, I'm going to try throwing to you again.
Uh-oh.
Jack pulls the trigger on John.
I mean, it's wild. I don't like... That's the only part of the episode I don't like, because I don't actually think Jack would do that.
I do like that he, you know, punches him a lot because he says he's going to kill him. And,
I do like that John basically has a "I was wrong" another "I was wrong" moment. You wouldn't kill me, as you know. Whoops.
But it also makes him slightly less villainous because the gun was never loaded.
I do want to do a Jack antagonist check-in moment, though.
Do it.
John does his own protagonist check-in, by the way. I don't know if you noticed. He goes back, he's like, listen, I risked my life to come back here and tell you, like, I am the protagonist. So I think he's heard you talking about him, Dave. Now let's do a Jack antagonist check-in moment. So, like, something about us talking about Jack and how he's frustrating. I've seen response from like old school Lost fans who love Jack, who are frustrated with us that we are hard on Jack. And a couple things crop up. Number one, I think that some of the original people who watched Lost back in the day are like, maybe you're seeing Jack through like too woke of a lens or something like that. Or number two, we actually had one woman write in who was like, I'll bet you'd be surprised to find out I'm a woman and I like Jack. So like this idea that like it's feminist to dislike Jack or something like that, which it might be. But I just thought I pull this quote from Alan Sepinwall back on a blog post he wrote back. And Alan already told us on our finale special, we did the series finale special. He's like, oh, I did not like Jack. So Alan has already like been like president of the No Jack Club on our podcast before, but I just thought I'd pull this like original, fresh off watching this episode reaction from Alan. Last year we started off with the bullying, obnoxious, stubborn to a lethal fault Jack, whose refusal to do the sensible thing at every single turn symbolized a season in which too little happened for far too long. Now we open with a spotlight on Hurley, the closest thing the show has to a fan surrogate. He's the guy who asks the right questions, even if he doesn't always get the right answers or get answers to them, cares about people's feelings, etc. And not only was it a Hurley spotlight, it was an episode in which he and Jack are at cross purposes and in which Hurley, up until the final scene in the mental hospital gym, and maybe even there, is depicted as right about virtually everything while Jack keeps being wrong about everything. Jack refuses to heed any warnings about the freighter, refuses to listen to Kate's concerns about where Naomi got to or the false blood trail, refuses to stray even one iota from the path he set for himself late last season. Hurley, meanwhile, asked Desmond what happened to Hurley, meanwhile, believes Charlie's message and is also the only guy on the beach who thinks to ask Desmond what happened to old Hoodie, which I guess is what Alan called Charlie. instead of Shappy, called him Hoodie. Fine. Throws the walkie-talkie in the ocean. Side note from Joanna, I don't think that was a good move from Hurley, but it did effectively end the argument at least. Okay, back to Alan. So everyone would stop bickering and start moving, recognizes that it's his place to tell Claire about Charlie, and convinces at least some people that Jack might be leading them to their death. If he wasn't throwing in with Locke, he probably would have gotten even more converts, as Rose made clear when she refused to go with that man. And I don't think it's a coincidence that in the basketball scene, Hurley makes every shot while Jack keeps missing. So that's some old school vintage Jack hate from Alan Sepinwall. Thought you would enjoy that.
I will say I'm enjoying Jack pre-beard off island.
Yeah.
But in this episode... on island, he insists he knows more about tracking than Kate. Ugh. Which seems objectively wrong. Like, mm-hmm. that if we as viewers know that, it seems like Jack has forgotten all that was made ado about there being two trackers in season one, and one was Locke and one was Kate.
I will object a little. Like, it's great to pit Kate against Jack, who's wrong. I'm a little object to Kate's skills being up against Rousseau's skills, because I think that Rousseau is an excellent tracker as well. And she's the one who's ultimately wrong about Naomi. But yeah, the moment this episode remembers that Kate can be very, very good, just like Saeed. And the moment where she steals the sat phone from Jack, where Ben does a little like game recognized game moment with Kate, which I love, like all of that is great. And it's something that the show too often forgets, I think, about Kate Austin, that she's incredible, incredibly capable, and is much more interesting when she's not just like following Jack in one direction or Sawyer in another, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is, yeah, I guess it's, maybe I don't hate that she has to go off on her own if it is the story being like, let's let Kate be badass by herself. So, fine. Maybe it had to happen. Maybe Jack had to be selectively dumb for me to get what I wanted, and it's not Jack being purposefully dumb like he has before, trying to protect Kate by not giving her a gun for some reason. I'm sorry, Neil? It sounded like you had a Jack or Kate thing to add.
No,
in.
I love. I'm just here for the Jack dunkathon.
Oh, nice.
I mean, it's okay. So Jack is you hear this term in sports a lot, especially in basketball. He's the irrational confidence guy. Like, it's unearned confidence in certain situations that gets Jack in trouble, where he's like, I have the right solution to this. No one can talk me out of it. And then he becomes stubborn about it. So this is a great example of where he's, I think Kate's pretty much right. She's like, Naomi's,
I think Neil's
smart.
making a good argument that we might be seeing a turn towards more of a faith-like belief from Jack, because
I mean,
that doesn't
maybe.
Sound based on facts.
It is sometimes very confusing to understand what it is that gives Jack this irrational confidence at times. I think, like, he made out with Juliet, and now he's like, obviously I know what's going to get us saved, and it's like...
Kissed a girl, told another one I loved her.
Listen, world's just being a weirdo, bud. If I got to kiss Elizabeth Mitchell, I might also have an elevated sense of self.
The two guys I've wanted to punch the most for the past 90-some days, I got to punch both of them, like, a lot.
And then kiss Juliet. Yeah. All right, Neil, I just want to ask you, did you read, our listener Colby did like a draft breakdown in our Slack about the Lost characters? Did you read that?
No, I don't think
I
saw that one.
Time permitting, I'm going to do this right now just because I don't understand it because I don't speak football. But I want your reaction. And Dave, if you have football opinions, yours too. But I know that Neil might be better equipped for this. Okay. Colby wrote Lost Draft Big Board. Number one, Hugo Reyes, offensive tackle. Reyes is your prototypical left tackle. Wide shoulders and hips, good footwork, elite hands, smart, instinctual player who can sniff out blitzes. He seems to love clearing lanes for the guys behind him. Expect him to play on Sundays for a long time. NFL comparison, Mitchell Schwartz. What do you think of that, Neil?
I don't know who Mitchell Schwartz is, but... I do agree that Hurley is a good lead blocker, metaphorically. okay, for a lot of missions on the island.
Okay, are you more of an NBA? You're more of an NBA guy and not NFL guy. But you played football,
so right? I'm very aware of football.
Okay, but like in terms of players playing now, you know more about the NBA than you do the NFL. Is that accurate?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Okay, got it. Okay, number two, Saeed Jarrah, safety. Can see the field and diagnose plays quickly. Great closing speed on deep balls. It doesn't matter if a corner gets beat; he'll save the touchdown. Oh yeah, he hits hard too. NFL comparison: Jamal Adams.
Okay. Saeed as a safety. I would have gone with more of a Tyrann Mathieu, whose nickname is the Honey Badger, because there are times when Saeed just goes into not giving a fuck mode and like jumps into action, and I think that's great.
Ankles into action.
All right, number three, John Locke, edge. Coming off a devastating injury, Locke has proven that he still has it. Relentless pursuer and always seems to find himself in the right place at the right time. He plays entirely off instinct and not very popular in the locker room, but a coach that can rein him in will wreak havoc on offensive lines across the league. NFL comparison, Joey Bosa.
Oh, okay. I'm aware of Joey Bosa. Sure. That's great. Locke is the troublesome locker room presence. Yeah, that makes sense.
All right, number four, Kate Austin, cornerback. You want someone who can track anyone on the field? Kate rarely gets beat on the outside, but sometimes gets her eyes stuck in the backfield trying to make a big play. NFL comparison, Marcus Peters.
I like this one because you know what you need two of at the very least on a defensive play in football? You need multiple cornerbacks who have this skill, this ability to read the play. So you get Kate on one side and Rousseau on the other side, and you've got yourself an amazing secondary.
Love this. Number five, James Sawyer Ford, quarterback. Character issues have caused Ford to slide down draft boards, but his constant ability to get defenses to react out of their best interest keeps him high for me. NFL comparison, Baker Mayfield.
Oh God, Baker Mayfield. All right, here's the thing. And I hope this doesn't spoil the rest of this list, which I have not seen. But I think of Sawyer and Jack both as quarterbacks. Sawyer is the one who was troublesome and maybe doesn't play well with others. The coaches don't like him, stuff like that. But he's the backup. Jack is the quarterback who starts the first couple games and is just terrible. It has to be replaced by Sawyer like four games into the 16 game season.
All the fans spray paint the X over their Jack flags. Yeah, like, exactly. All right, exactly.
The whole fandom turns on Jack and supports Sawyer's quarterbacking, even though he's still mediocre, just like Baker Mayfield.
All right. Sun Hwa Kwon, wide receiver. Nothing flashy about Kwon. She never gets too high or too low. A reliable possession receiver who is sure to bring the game day drip pregame. NFL comparison, Larry Fitzgerald.
Oh, I like that. There's this wise calm to Larry Fitzgerald as a player. And I would say that Sun has that. I am curious to see where Jin ends up on the field, though.
I don't think Jin's on this list. All right, number seven.
Oh, no. Jin would be like the tight end okay. who's like always split out wide with yep. Sun. So they're like always on the same side of the formation together.
Just as good protecting the quarterback as he is running a button hook.
Sure.
Little Jin.
All right, speaking of, number seven, Juliet Burke, tight end. She's as heady as anyone on the field and versatile as hell. Look to Burke as a red zone threat that will fit in any offense. NFL comparison, George Kittle.
All right. Yeah, I mean, Juliet would be the most, like, she's very reliable in a lot of different situations. She's very versatile. So, yeah.
And, yeah, like, that whole season three thing of, like, it seemed like anywhere the wind blows, that's where Juliet was, but not really once you get the bigger picture. Okay. Number eight, we're almost done here. Number eight, Walt Lloyd, running back, the youngest player in this year's draft. He's a shifty scat back that can get lost in the trees inside. But before you know it, he's gone. NFL comparison, Tariq Cohen.
Also prone to unexpected growth spurts. So Tariq. That works out pretty well.
Excellent. Number nine, Jack Shepard, safety. Oh, wait, hold on. This former quarterback still wants to lead, but his unrefined athleticism is best served in a position he can roam around. Wildly inconsistent, but occasionally makes the big play. NFL comparison, Trey Boston.
Yeah, see, this is one I think I disagree with to a certain point, which is Jack is the quarterback who, like, busts his ACL and then refuses to come out of the game because he thinks he knows better than the coach and the medical staff.
All right, last one. Number 10, Ben Linus, middle linebacker. Definitely undersized, but can lead a defense like anyone. He's great at disguising his looks and will continue to force offenses into mistakes. NFL comparison, Kiko Alonso. So
yeah, also can take a hit. Like a lot of hits.
Yeah.
Directly to the face.
You gotta love this episode for giving the people exactly what they want, which is more Russo punching Ben.
Yeah. Well, and also I think the show, speaking of Ben, the show does a good job of doing some dunking on Jack, like mid episode, and using Ben for that one is an amazing choice. Like having Ben be the one to make fun of Jack as it's going poorly. I like it.
So anyway, that was something that Colby got up to in the Slack, which I just like loved, even though I didn't, I like 90% of it is gibberish to me. I loved it. It made me laugh. So I hope that's okay that I read that all out for y'all.
All right. We're going to talk slightly based off of what Alan Sepinwall was talking about as Hurley being like an audience surrogate. We're going to throw to Joanna again. Because unless this is talking about a certain movie where Val Kilmer turns into a pig, I think Hurley as Willow is referring Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Okay, so here's something that they used to say in the Buffy writer's room all the time, which is that if the character of Willow on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, who's played by Allison Hannigan, if she cries, they knew that the audience would cry. So they were like pretty sparing with that, but they knew when to deploy it to like destroy us. And I think the same is true for Hurley, for Jorge Garcia. Not that Hurley cries a lot, because he doesn't, but like basically whatever Hurley is feeling, I'm gonna feel. So if it's like complete elation at landing a cannonball, I'm gonna feel that.
And
if,
immediately down to Charlie is dead.
And if it's like, if it's you know, being frantic over Where's Charlie, if it's being upset that Charlie's dead, and if I'm crying again thinking about it. I watched this morning. I've watched this series through, this is my third time through in like since we started this podcast. I've seen this episode so many times, and I wept every time that Hurley was upset. So Hurley finding out from Desmond, and then Hurley later having to tell Claire, just devastating to me. So I think that that's just something to look out for. The show knowing that that's a strength, an ace up their sleeve that they have, is Jorge Garcia. So I mean, the other thing about Jorge Garcia, a couple other things, like you use Hurley in other ways, like you know, we see in this episode Sawyer really trying to be supportive to Hurley. And that's a huge, like, we've talked in the past about some of our first time watchers being like, we don't understand how you can like Sawyer so much based off like the beginning of season one. And we're like, don't worry, we're on a ride. He's going places. And a big way to put him somewhere is to make him friendly to Hurley, right? Be nice to Hurley and we like you better. And he's very nice to Hurley in this episode. Yeah.
And it also, it fits really neatly in a narrative sense with all the work they've done sort of the opposite direction. Like, remember who was the one who figured out how to engage Sawyer with the rest of the beach camp after he stole everybody's guns and became the sheriff, you know, like, so Hurley,
some of that making barbecue.
Yeah, some of that may have felt like treading water, but it, like every Hurley thing, anything that feel, you know, even if it feels like he's treading water, it always seems to matter as you go forward. It's like whatever moves Hurley is making on the island, it comes back in some sort of really good emotional payoff. And I think this scene's a really great example of that, because it's like it feels out of character for Sawyer to want to, you know, help, you know, listen to anyone. But it doesn't feel that weird that it's Hurley, because they've had this whole journey through, you know, three seasons. And it's really excellent choices all
and
around,
listen,
by the writer's room.
Hurley has a BFF vacancy. So like, you know,
he certainly does now.
If like I honestly kind of feel like the reason that Sawyer goes with John is because Hurley went with John and Sawyer's following Hurley, and that just speaks well to Sawyer's character, right? The meta level of this is that by all accounts Matthew Fox was a challenging person to work with, And the only person who I've heard like speak glowingly about Matthew Fox is Jorge Garcia, who's like, oh, Matt and I would just we would always crack each other up on takes. Right. So when you see Jack walk into that basketball court and he's got this like huge smile on his face, that to me feels like really genuinely like Matthew Fox just loves doing scenes with Jorge Garcia. And he's like, look what I get to do. So that's just like a
he's like, fuck yeah, this is so much better than that beard shit. They wouldn't tell me why I was doing it. Just running around. And then before that, I was getting tattoos. Finally, just a game of horse with Hurley. It's going to be great.
The best.
Where do we want to go? How do we want to get to the cabin? Coming out of Hurley. Hurley accesses the cabin, which me, as somebody who is now questioning everything, is making a small list of people who are able to access the cabin. So we've seen Locke there. We've seen Ben there. Ben was apparently leading Locke to the cabin that he knew where it was. But here, the cabin definitely makes a point of moving, or the vision of the cabin makes a point of moving. And while Locke and Ben both got to go into the cabin, we didn't see that Ben actually saw or heard anything, even though he claimed. We heard Locke here, help me, and now we've seen Hurley show a shape sitting in a chair, which was Christian Shepherd, and then an eye, and here we catch up with our flashback from earlier in the episode, a picture of a dog that is hanging on the wall of the cabin, which maybe the dog is Jacob, but we know for sure is a dog named Honolulu, who was a rescue by Jack Bender's daughter, and was painted by a person who played a others extra, and is now hanging in Jacob's cabin. That Lulu the Jack Bender dog. But I like the idea that Jacob could be the dog. We have this idea that Jacob's like a person or a god. Why not a god dog? It's spelled backwards. That seems really losty, right?
Sure. Yeah, and I mean, I like the brevity of this scene with the cabin, where it's like, all right, the cabin shows up. Hurley does his close his eyes and count to five thing, which he does several times in this episode. It moves, and then it disappears, and then Locke is there, and then we move on, and it's just pure mystery stuff. Just inject it right into the veins. Like, pure, what the hell is this still? And I like that. I like that it's like, we're not getting very many answers about the cabin just yet.
Yeah, it's the apparently it could be the island reaching out to Hurley, or it could be Hurley manifesting things on the island again, but like, it seems like no reason for Hurley to manifest the cabin mystery. I wonder if we're going to revisit that this season. Seems likely.
Yeah,
we're on cabin watch.
We're unclear how much we can say about what we see in the cabin. So just if you're listening and you're Stormy and you're like, why aren't they saying blah? Like, I don't know. We're just trying to play it a little safe with what we see in there. Right?
Oh, yeah. There's an eye. That's the other thing I didn't mention, but I should probably mention, because it's not like that's a huge spoiler. You all see an eye. It scares them away. But yeah, that's cabin. More cabin, probably. Keep some eyes on the cabin. We got eyes on the cabin. We got eyes on the Oceanic 6. We got eyes on the different teams. Is there anything we need to cover before we hit corners?
Yeah. Really quickly. I need to do some hair check-in. Which is that, if you noticed, Emily DeRaven's hair might look a little different to you this season. It's because she's wearing a wig, because she cut her hair to co-star with Johnny Depp in Public Enemies. So, the great choice. Cut her all her hair off for that film that will live in posterity. Anyway, so yeah, so Claire's got a long blonde wig on, or Emily DeRaven has a long blonde wig. Conversely, lovely Dominic Monaghan got a very, very, very good haircut. So Apparition Charlie has some great, and I love this episode for that. I think the way that it handles Charlie in terms of like, there's careful mourning for Charlie in this episode. We see it hit Hurley, we see it hit Claire, and we see it hit a bunch of other people who are dealing with the aftermath of that. But then we also, like, get some Dom Monaghan. We get like fun Charlie too. It's not like annoying Charlie from before. It's Charlie at the end of season three who we liked. So we're like, hey, fun apparition Charlie. Great. So
yeah, I mean, that's a really good story trope to actually, I'm going to insert this now because otherwise it's not going to fit. Matthew Fox lost weight to put be in Speed Racer, which is actually a good choice. So we're glad he did that. But Jack's a little lighter at the beginning of this episode.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
But I also like this trope of using an empathetic character that has been through trauma to also be a character that sees ghosts is a great ghost story trope. So, like, there's a part of me that's like, you know, are we seeing, like, some sort of mysterious island magic? And then there's part of me that is like, this is just Hurley's reaction to dealing with Charlie, and the entire episode is emotionally built sort of around that. So it feels like it can be a question and it can be both at the same time, which I think is like when good like horror films, for example, because I'm pulling from things that do mostly ghosts, when they're able to find that overlap between the subject and like the character based text of the actual thing, it yeah. really meshes well.
Oh, I like that. As someone who just like rewatched all of The Haunting of Hill House, I'm a big fan of that. Yeah. I'm like, and we do have some questions about what Hurley is seeing and how Charlie relates to Dave and what are the rules here and what are we looking at? Hurley can touch both of those, both Dave and Charlie, right? He puts his arm around Dave in the episode mm-hmm. Dave, and he gets slapped in the face by Charlie in this episode. So it's not, so we're figuring out what's going on. We still don't know, right?
Okay? Yeah, that's right. I don't think we know. I mean, we know what Charlie says, which is that he's dead, but also there.
Correct.
And we know what Hugo sees, but it lives in that wonderful squishy space I was talking about where they're both equally as real. It kind of doesn't matter at this point because what we're concerned about is there's either something in Hugo or something in the fabric of the universe that is worried that Hugo's off the island.
Mm-hmm. Also, the interesting thing about the ghost Charlie thing, I mean, not to say that is a ghost, is that
that's why I'm another going with apparition. Apparition is sure. neutral.
is that another character sees him and he's like, you better be careful. That guy is watching you. And it's like, all right, well,
yeah, if but it's a ghost. Like, I could just like, it's, I can see the Lost Writers Room at this point in time.
Being like, it's a mental hospital. Yeah, people being see like,
yeah, exactly, exactly. With their limited understanding of mental health that is apparent so far in the series. On that note, I do want to call out something really quickly centered on Charlie. I want to take you on this roller coaster that I went on reading this Jeff Jensen recap. Jeff Jensen, friend of the show, big fan, love Jeff. So my reaction when Rose is like, Claire, we all know your man is the hero. Better give him. I was like, blech. I did not like that. Okay. Rose is usually the best. When she's like, better fuck your man to say thank you for saving us, I was like, not into that. So I was reading Jeff's recap and he's like, so this is one paragraph. And that Rose and Claire moment in which Bernard's wife told Aaron's mommy that she better reward Hero Charlie with some beach blanket action. Yuck. And I was like, yes, Jeff Jensen, giving me like a nice like 2020 feeling reaction to this sequence. And then Jeff adds, and for the record, I appreciate very, very much the whole concept of getting some something, something from the Liddies, if you know what I'm saying. And I was like, oh, Jeff. That's some internalized masculine performative whatever.
I guess,
anyway.
Here's the question, though. Which comment, unnecessarily, I guess, horny comment in this episode, it feels more out of place? Is it Rose's thing, or is it what the detective guy says about Ana Lucia? Where he's like,
she's gorgeous.
She was a good cop. She was gorgeous. It's like, wait, what does that have to do with it?
Oh, Uncle Mike.
Also, one of those statements was true because you know what happened, why she's not on the force anymore. Anyway.
Yeah.
Well, maybe not. Maybe that didn't happen in whatever flash forward life we're living now. It's all lies.
I think the last thing I want to say before we get to the corners, I know that we're going long. The last thing I want to say, I just want to keep it in the same vein as we're keeping an eye out for, like, H-O-H-O-H-O, at least in Hurley's storyline. I want to keep a lookout for, like, stuff related to smoke off-island. For example, in the interrogation room with Hurley and Uncle Mike, it says no smoking on the wall in enormous letters for some reason. So I just want to put a pin in that and see if we see other things going forward that might be interesting in that way.
All right.
Fair. All right.
Keep an eye out for the old clickety-clack.
Always, right?
Neil, do we have a Giacchino corner this week?
We do. There's a couple interesting, you know, Giacchino, I'm sure, was very tired after doing an entire disc for the season 3 finale of Tracks. The best one I saw from the season 4 premiere soundtrack is a track called Locking Horns.
Oh, no. I do think the best Giacchino moment actually is because he does a little bit of the raft theme when Hurley does his cannonball. And that, it's great. It's just really
good. Yeah, I mean, the music is strong. The puns, less so.
No, Locking Horns, not great.
Our Jungle of Mystery moment is, well, we've already explained Charlie's new haircut. So let's say the man fallen out of the helicopters looking for Jack.
The second parachutist.
The second parachutist.
Is he a polyglot? We'll find out.
We will find out. Certainly something new. The Boone Carlo Memorial Falling Down Award. But I think we've discussed this as being total vertical distance. So either way, it's going to go to Hurley. But I think we're going to give it to him for the cannonball and not falling down outside the cabin. We'll give him a joyous falling down award in honor of Boone. Remember Boone?
Yeah.
That was a while ago. All right, the Desmond Button corner. I think we're still at DesCon 4, but someone has entered in here wet, which is definitely true. A wet DesCon 4.
I don't know which respectful horn dog on this podcast did that.
there's a couple of shots as they're entering the jungle where both Desmond and Sawyer are glistening.
Mm-hmm.
And Saeed.
Oh, and Saeed, yeah. There's like a really just sweaty group of people.
Correct.
And it's a lot to deal with.
The Henry Gale Memorial, obviously a lie award, is when Kate says to Jack, you're right, and then steals the sat phone. Because
there's so many lies in this episode, but we had to give it to Kate because it's so good.
All right, it's time for a Jungle of Kistery. This is where we ask our listeners to nominate two people that should be a kissin', and then we do a Twitter poll that week to let you guys choose. Joanna, how did we fare for the season 3 finale through the Looking Glass?
Yeah, so we had a lot of good candidates for that. Mikhail and the Kiss of Death only got 13.4% of the vote. Too bad, so sad, by Mikhail. Saeed's ankles, I'm surprised they didn't rank higher, but they only got 24.7% of the vote. Those ankles as they kissed each other and killed someone. The Dharma Van and Ryan, pretty high, maybe because of Hurley's involvement, 27.8% of the vote. But top of the list, so high, it's making a comeback this week, spoiler alert. Ben and Rousseau's fist, 34% of the vote. So there you go. So in this week's episode, we have, as I said, the return of Danielle's fist and Ben's face. That's from our listener, Mel. I'm okay with putting that back on the rotation. Why not? Hurley and Hot Charlie was nominated by our listener, Phil. So Charlie and his haircut and his, like, rock star, like, ensemble and Hurley. Sure. A lot of people were really excited that the person who lands on the island is Jeremy Davies, who's an actor a lot of people know from various work, including Justified is a big one for Jeremy Davies. He played Jesus on American Gods. He's been around, so people were really excited to see Jeremy Davies show up. They didn't really, like, nominate a recipient for Jeremy Davis. They were just like, when I said, give me your Kistory nominations, they were just like, Jeremy Davis. So you can say Jeremy Davis and himself. I'm going to give it to Jeremy Davis and Jack because, you know, he takes off his helmet and he's like, are you Jack? You know what I mean? Like, hi. Like, you know what I mean? So let's give it to Jeremy Davis, whoever he's playing, and Jack. But the last one I think is the one that's going to take it. This is the most popular nomination. It was from Bronwyn and a bunch of other people. Yes, anding her, which is Kate and Naomi. So they do some... you know, some close talking before Naomi leaves us. Also, should I mention here really quickly that we have should we mention the voice on the sat phone or not? Do we think that's a spoiler?
It's different than the last episode.
It's different it is than the different last time the we last heard episode. It.
Yes.
It's
I think that's all you really need to know so
it's
far.
Very recognizable, I would say. And okay, fine. I'll keep it. I'll stow it.
Well, speaking of Naomi with Kate and Naomi, first of all, we'll put that poll up at Storm Podcast on Twitter. You could go vote. Yes. Second of all, Naomi is the recipient of a new award this season, which will be the Charlie Pace Memorial Final Words Award. If somebody has some very notable final words, as if Naomi's Tell My Sister I Love Her, which she ekes out after having never talked about anything personal. The entire time she's been there and
where
dying.
Do you think her sister is? Back in Manchester?
Probably.
On the freighter?
Oh, man. Oh. Twin sister Naomi? We're going to get all Twin Peaks season 3 up in here?
I want to know Naomi's twin sister's name. Yeah, Naomi Dorrit. R.I.P. Yeah, if Charlie Pace's final words effectively in Chappie on his hand is not Penny's boat. Which, despite what Sawyer said, is an iconic thing to say when you die. yeah, let's just shout out the good final words of our future. And I thought we could use a new corner that had a more recent character than Henry Gale or Boone Carlyle. So there we go.
New corner. All right, guys, that means it's time for The Storm, which we will get to right after this.
Get fresh, pre-measured ingredients and mouth-watering seasonal recipes delivered right to your door with HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit. HelloFresh lets you skip those trips to the grocery store and makes home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. Listen, we're all in a place right now where we want to save some money. We want to save ourselves some stress. We don't need extra stress in 2020. You can save 40% off your usual grocery budget by using HelloFresh versus shopping at your local store, and it's more convenient, too. Plus, listen, we're all indoors. We're not getting out the way we should. We're not taking care of ourselves maybe the way... Maybe our sleep is bad. Over 90% of ingredients are sourced directly from growers to ensure the freshest recipes are delivered to your door. And it's flexible. You can keep your fridge stocked by adding extra proteins or sides like garlic bread to your weekly order. So yeah, check out America's number one meal kit, HelloFresh.
You know, I did, because I made some smokehouse pulled chicken bowls with buttery jalapeno corn, pickled shallot, and lime crema. I've talked about this before, but HelloFresh makes me look like a good cook when I am not. Struggle with basic things. And as we were talking about, Neil, even something like lime crema, which sounds super complex, isn't. With HelloFresh's instructions and proportions that are perfect for me and my household where I eat meat, and my partner does not. So I could get some all-vegetable, vegan-friendly meals and some meaty meals, like the smokehouse pulled chicken bowls with buttery jalapeno corn, which, man, I just love saying as much as I loved eating.
Well, now that I'm hungry, I'm going to go to HelloFresh.com/Storm80 and use code STORM80 to get $80 off across 5 boxes, including free shipping on your first box. If you would like to join me, here it is again. Go to HelloFresh.com/STORM80. Use the code STORM80. Get $80 off of your first 5 boxes. Get some free shipping on your first box as well. Do it. Just, like, do it now.
Now is time on the podcast where we like to thank our $10 or above subscribers on our Patreon. Thank you all so much. Starting with some newcomers, Michael Hine, Aaron Michael Augustini, Joe Measures, Bryce Quine, Ira Storm, Melissa Slaughter, Great on Toast, Victoria McDuffie, Marion Donnelly, Jim Scott, Stacey Winklepeck, Pleck, Jocelyn, Juan DeMello, Cody Dragies, Fiona Grimm, Aaron, Brian Rapp, Holly Hunt, Kelly Donahue, and Ashley Reese. Thank you all so much.
And I would like to thank Tom Brady as Dexter Morgan. As you can see, you guys can put whatever you want in here. Bob Augustus, Soundwave 815. Ooh, I see what you did there. Soundwave ho. Ashley Lopez, Michael Nolt, Stacy Axelrod, Mike McLaughlin, Madison Ray, Carrie, Jason Blackmer, Robert Bowles, Chuck Parkey, Cameron Graham, Mark Jewett, Tom Shapansky, McNick, James Barda, Jocelyn Land, Callie Serrano, and Jeremiah Perez. Thank you very much.
And I would like to thank the following fine humans, including Micah Wood, Sarah Gates, Steve Bolvari, Jane Phelps, Christina McNeesett, Brian Latino, Ben Block, Maggie Pollan, Benjamin Jacoby, Matt Hayes, Tiffany Welker, Laura Kaminsky, Wendy Marshall, Joseph Johnston, Brenda Moran, Russell Brody, Carrie Labadia, Nell? Yeah, okay. Samantha Sherburn, and Georgia Monroe Cook. Thank you all very much.
Back for the storm. Joanna, you want to get into this writer's strike thing as promised, and you have made some very good notes here and have done a lot of reading. So how about you steer us through this and Neil and I could yes and you.
Okay, sounds good. All right, so the original plan for season 4 of Lost, as you may know, is that there were supposed to be 16 episodes, and they were going to do them 8 and 8, but they only got through the first 8 before the writer's strike shut them down. So with one lingering question I have, what happens to the first 8 episodes seems to be like have been their plan all along, and then they had to adjust in the back half. And when they came back, they were only supposed to have 5 episodes because ABC, they were like, when you end with season 8, which is Meet Kevin Johnston, so there's a bit of a cliffhanger in that episode. It ends with like Rousseau and Carl getting shot and all this stuff like that. There's a bit of a like cliffhanger stuff, and so Carlton and Damon were like, well, if that has to be our season finale, so be it. Like, we can make that work. And they were thinking of just pushing the rest of the episodes into a season 5. And ABC's like, nah, we're going to come back, but you only get 5 episodes to do what you were going to do in 8 episodes. And so they were like, oh, okay, sure, we'll figure that out. And then they ultimately ended up getting an extra hour. They got 6 episodes because they wound up writing a 3-hour finale. So all told, there are 14 episodes that were originally supposed to be 16 episodes, and then were supposed to be 13 episodes, but landed in 14 episodes. And the major plans that seem to have shifted is that they had planned to do the backstory of our new freighter crew in those back 8 episodes, plus a Rousseau centric episode. So we were supposed to have a Miles episode, a Dan episode, a Charlotte episode, and a Rousseau episode. The way that they solved that, none of those people got episodes this season. The way they solved that is they shifted the Dan and the Miles episode into season 5. So they get their centric episodes in season 5. Charlotte's backstory is somewhat revealed via like some time travel stuff. And then they do the same thing for Rousseau. The question I have, and that's all like pretty clever problem solving for that. And I don't think the last 5 episodes feel like they really are missing something. Like, I think it's all there, what needs to be there. A question I have around that is like, where were they going to put the Rousseau episode? Because like Rousseau gets shot point blank at the end of episode 8. So was like her episode going to, was her episode 9? Where we like cut back to the present and her dead body? Or I rewatched the end of episode 8 when I was trying to figure this out. I was rewatched to be like, did they shoot just this part and just shove her death in there? Because her death, Carl and Rousseau's death, feels very abrupt. And that's fine for Carl, but for Rousseau, it just doesn't feel great to me.
Well, I mean, you might not be wrong though, because if you come out of episode 9, she's dead, but also, what is it, Alex is like, I'm Ben's daughter.
Yeah.
So you just go back and immediately show how that's false. Like, I that seems like a losty, you know, like, little twist to me, because we suspect that it's false at this point, because, you know, yeah, she says it's not your daughter and everything, and so, but it, to actually, like, sort of see that might be kind of Locke's paralyzed-ish amount of backstory.
Yeah, and cut back to her just, like, dead on the ground or whatever. Could be effective.
It would make it so much more tragic if we just saw the entire life of Russo, like, trying to get back to her daughter, and she finally does get shot by freighter people.
And we can talk about that definitely more when we get there. I will say that, like, there's parts of me that likes the Russo death here, only because, like, Russo survived so long by staying out of everyone's business, and then in finding her daughter, she was inextricably drawn back into people's business, and that's what got her in the end. So, right. Like, I kind of like that.
Well, do you wonder, would more of her backstory be tied slightly more into Charles Widmore's searching for the island, you know, if she was in the back nine? Somehow.
It may be. It just feels like it would be more of a ceremony around her death than, like, she dies, and, like, she dies in episode 8, and then she doesn't come back until the flash sideways in the final season. You know what I mean? And that just feels, like, really abrupt to me, to such a big character. I was reading up on Mira Furlan said in an interview, like, apparently there's this rumor that she was written off that way because the writer said she wanted to leave the show. She has since given an interview saying, I don't know where that rumor started, because that was not the case. I love doing the show. So I don't know what's going on there. But what's also interesting is that Russo is the guest star to have appeared in the most episodes. So, you know, like, she just feels very important to the show. And it's just sort of, anyway, we'll talk about that more as the season go on. But I do think that it's interesting that the freighter stuff is so effective versus, I find it effective, at least, versus, well, sorry, to circle back to Charlotte, another thing, like, people, I don't really like the character of Charlotte. We will talk about that a lot as this season unfurls. But, you know, there's some question about, like, whether Charlotte wasn't well served by, like, would Charlotte have been better served by the writer's strike and stuff like that, if she had gotten her episode in this season. Rebecca Mader, the actress who plays Charlotte, has said in interviews that she was only signed on for 8 episodes initially, and she eventually got to do 20. So they actually gave her more than she was originally signed on for. She was always supposed to be a very short-term character. And what's interesting is that in interviews, Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse would not commit to whether or not the freighter people were going to stick around for the long haul. They just said, like, maybe.
We've been burned by some tailies long enough.
Exactly. So I feel like the introduction of the tailies and Nikki and Paolo, like, making a big deal out of them, they were, like, hedging their bets. And they're like, okay, if these characters are successful, so Miles and Dan become series regulars in season 5. Miles is important. You know, Dan is important to the fabric of the show. Miles, from a screen time perspective, is important all the way to the end. Like, he's on the final Ajira flight off the island. And not to mention Lapidus, you know what I mean? So, like, the freighter people pay off in the long run. And part of that, yeah, is, I think, them hedging their bets, not making such a big deal of it. Unlike Nikki and Paolo and the tailies, the freighter people weren't in the promo material for the season. They were just sort of, they just were more cautious with how they enrolled them. And also just saving their backstory until season 5, though it was kind of an accident, I think it serves them well, because I think you avoid something like the Ana Lucia of it all in season 2, when we're like, why are we spending so much time on Ana Lucia when we want, like, when our main, like, we want to, like, see what's happening with our main group and move them forward. So, like, I think by the time we get to a Dan flashback and a Miles flashback, we're emotionally invested in them as characters. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Okay, I have more info. I don't mean a monologue or whatever, but the whole season is only 17 days, which I think is fascinating. And I think that that's part of its whole, like, it just feels like a lot of brisk forward momentum. And they intentionally did. Lindelof gave an interview where he likened it to book 7 of Harry Potter, which breaks from the, like, year at Hogwarts format.
Right.
So they avoided a lot of the things that they had done in the past. So you don't get the Sydney airport. You don't see the plane crash again. You don't get Sarah. You don't get Locke's dad. You don't get Ethan. Like, a bunch of the guest stars that they had relied, that they had, like, revisited a bunch. I mean, they're flashback guest stars, a lot of them, but, like, are absent from the season. So it just really does feel like a different perspective, a different format.
I mean, you're always going to notice a lack of Mapother energy.
You know, so. I just laugh because anytime someone's like, and book 7, I'm like, oh, the camping book. So that's how Harry Potter has.
I thought book 8 is the camping book.
Oh yeah, book 8 is the camping book, and book 7 is the first one without. Okay, good. So never mind. Yeah. It would have been funnier if he said book 8 because people camp a lot on the island. And people camp a lot in that book.
It's true. I was reading this Entertainment Weekly cover story where Jeff Jensen went on set in the hiatus, so between the first 8 episodes and the 5 that came back, or the 6 that came back, and Matthew Fox gave this quote where he's like, our first 8 episodes by design were all set up for these episodes to come. That we're doing just 5 instead of 8 means they're even more packed with plot. It's payoff time. So, you know, imagine planning your season to be like 8 episodes of questions, 8 episodes of answers. And then the writer strikes like, JK, you get 5. Good luck.
Oh, no, we're not getting to the coffin till the end now. Oh, well, they'll wait.
Every person of the Oceanic Six, like, all the major characters get episodes except for Claire. And once again, the Claire thing I have questions about whether or not that is tied at all to the writer's strike. Because she just disappears in a way that's kind of fun and mysterious, but also feels a little abrupt for such a central character. So I don't know if the Claire thing is a victim of the writer's strike, but Claire doesn't get an episode and Sawyer doesn't get an episode, which is surprising because I think about Sawyer a lot when I think about season 4. But I think that's just because there's so much Barrick stuff, and there's all that we talked in the calm about, like, his relationship with Hurley that just deepens in this season to the point where you get the payoff with the when they're in the helicopter at the end of the season going to the freighter and Sawyer jumps off to, like, sacrifice himself for Kate, yes, but also, like, basically Lapidus is like, oh, we gotta ditch some weight, and Hurley's looking, like, really anxious and like, oh shit, like, it should be me, blah blah, and that's when Sawyer jumps. So that just feels like a, it's not just about Kate moment. It's about, like, that on island stuff is really moving the needle on Sawyer's character.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love, again, I love that they tie Hurley and Sawyer together. Like, that just has always felt like one of the best duos.
It's great.
And I'm so happy that we're getting into the part where they become roommates.
I wanted to ask you, Neil, about, like, what you think about, do you feel like them starting with a Hurley episode in, like, instead of a Jack episode, do you feel like that's an indication that they already know now here that Hurley is the guy? I mean, it's his episode, and also he sees Jacob's cabin. Like, do they know that Hurley's the guy?
Yeah, it's really, okay, so if we were to sit down with Mr. Lindelof and Cuse and ask them, and they were to say, we had no idea, I don't know if I would believe that, because there is, as you have explained, tons of evidence at this point that they're setting up Hurley to be, it seems like at this point, they've, by the end of season 3, they've figured out that Hurley is definitely the emotional core for the audience, but they are sort of setting him up to, like, yeah, to just, it would be really hard for me to believe that they didn't at least have some idea that Hurley was going to be the guy at the end, you know, as the steward of the island. But I guess it also tracks with, you know, we talked about a couple episodes ago how they had announced the finale date prior to what was Greatest Hits, maybe? It was like right before Greatest Hits aired.
For 2010, yeah.
Yeah, they announced, okay, we know when we're going to end the show. So it's hard not to believe that they had some idea of the basic structure of the ending. So, you know, the church, the idea that the island needs a steward, you know, all of the sort of back stuff with Man in Black and Jacob. So, yeah, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, I've always loved the choice of Hurley to open season 4 because it's, this episode changes so much of what we understand Lost to be, of like the rhythm of the show. And I think the only way you can do, one of the only ways you can do that effectively is by using a character who just has infinite goodwill with the audience, right? So Hurley is the guy that we all like. Like, you'd be very hard pressed to find someone that doesn't like Hurley. So when you go to make this huge like pivot to the depth of the flash forwards, to the Oceanic Six, all that stuff, Hurley is such a wonderful vessel for that, you know?
I feel like they probably knew like about Hurley at the end at this time, because that feels correct what Joanna said about mm-hmm. the cabin, and then sort of like this weird production fact that Hurley was going to be see himself in Jacob's cabin before the network was like, that's too weird, make a Christian Shepherd.
And they're like, get John Terry on the phone. Yeah.
Which is interesting, because knowing how Christian Shepherd plays out in season 4, they don't know he's the smoke monster yet, I don't think. Like, that doesn't really track as well as Hurley's in the final, you know, candidacy. So there's definitely, like, evidence that they have some parts of the ending in mind already and are working towards it. But there are other things that are not quite as solid. Mm-hmm. Which we'll see how it goes, but man, like that, I'm gonna have some real questions during the Cabin Fever episode about who's on whose side about bringing who to the island, given what we know about the smoke monster and who has access to the cabin.
I need to do more research on this. I forgot to pull on this particular thread, but like, so I feel like I mostly understand what happened with Rousseau and with Charlotte. I still have questions about Abaddon, because there's so many seeds planted here. We know that they wanted Lance Reddick.
Oh, I have an answer.
Okay.
They didn't have Nestor Carbonell until after the writer's strike, because he was on another show that got canceled. So when he shows up later in this season, like watching John Locke's birth, and then, you know, Aberdeen's also there, they were playing with having
Abaddon.
Abaddon.
Yeah.
They were playing with somebody that had to take the Richard spot in case, because his whatever show he was on, Kane or something, they had said, like, enough with taking one of our stars to do your, like, guest spots on your super popular show. Like, you aren't allowed to have him anymore. And so during production, they were like, oh, no, we need like another Richard, like another off-island guy that could do our bidding. And then during the writer's strike, Kane or whatever the show decided they weren't coming back, and they freed up Nestor Carbonell again. So I would assume that they wanted to keep him around, but at least that's why Lance Reddick kind of comes out of the gate swinging as hard as he does in season 4.
Him being there is great, but then like they just drop him and they kill him like really unceremoniously in season 5.
Yeah.
So like they just, that's a, I don't know if that's a writer strike thing, if they were just sort of like, we were gonna do a thing, because even if like Richard comes back, and I agree that like Nestor Carbonell and Richard is like, it's so strong, so like I wouldn't replace him necessarily with Abaddon, but like I also, especially if I already had a reputation for building a lot of mysteries and not answering them, do all the shit they do with Abaddon and not pay it off in any way whatsoever. Because he says a lot of stuff, you know what I mean? So
yeah, let me Google one more thing and maybe I could have a better, even better answer for you.
Like what Lance Reddick, when Fringe started?
Fringe started September 9th, 2008. So that's it.
Okay. All right, fine. Lance Reddick got killed off unceremoniously in season 5 because he could be on Fringe. Great. Love it. Love it for Lance Reddick. Great stuff. Okay. And then I want to talk about one of my favorite lines from the season 3 finale that we didn't discuss at the time, but it makes me laugh every time. Jack's on the walkie. Or no, he's talking to Ben, I guess. And he's like, I'm going to save them all. I'm going to get them home. Every single one. Then I'm going to kill you or whatever it is he says. But just like enjoy all the Losties that are still hanging around. None of whom make it to the end of the season. None of whom will ever make it off the island. All these extras.
He gets 6 off this season.
Right.
And then he personally gets 0 off when he gets back to the island. That's exactly. All Lupitas and Kate.
I mean, so we're back to Jack's irrational confidence.
It's just really like, that's one of my favorite aspects of, I think it's season six, maybe it's season five, and the flaming arrow attack and then just like blowing up the rest of the Losties. And that's it. Like the extras, the red shirts. I mean, they kind of lampshaded a bit by adding the Neil, the Froger guy, but like, it's just funny watching how many, like, they must be in the writers and being like, oh my God, we have so many extras that we have to like drag around the jungle still when nobody cares.
We thought this would be a flashback show for years. We didn't know that we would have to have answers. Damn it.
Like, notice that none of the extras are stupid enough to go to the barracks with John, it seems, I think.
There's a couple.
Yeah. Oh, there's a couple.
No,
okay.
Yeah, because they have just to kill, couple, like, though. They have to kill, like, seven or eight.
Oh, right, because there's explosions at the yeah, barracks. Yeah. Okay. Need some insulation to go off to the barracks with them. So, yeah, keep your eye on those extras and how they all die between now and the end. Yeah, that's all. I mean, that's all I have to say about. I just think it's fascinating.
It's fascinating
to, like, find out, you know, how storytelling is impacted by external forces.
Well, and this gets to be, yeah, one of the things we get to track in the storm alongside this. Get ready for some season four questions. We have them. How do we make sense of the Michael timeline?
It doesn't.
Charles Widmore, what? Like,
this is the beginning of Hurley Can See Dead People, right? Like,
this is the beginning of Hurley. Well, yeah. See, and I don't know what episode we bring that up, because that's like sort of treated as he could be on the edge of whatever, and then Christian Shepherd shows up to Jack, which makes Jack's go up and ask my father like slightly less drug addled than it was in the finale, but still like I have questions about who could appear off the island and why, and when people are being emotionally distraught and when it's actually ghosts. But yeah, I mean, Ben gets thrown 10 months into the future because it needs to make sense for the plot. So there's stuff like that that we could sort of look at and try to figure out.
Are you saying whatever happens, happens?
yes, but I don't think they say that until season five. So we have to learn that the hard way.
I think, I just think it's useful to think of this season as like the before times and the after times. So like the first eight episodes.
They're like, we know exactly what we're doing.
What? Okay.
Oh, no. Sorry, you were going to say the first eight episodes like season three. I was going to contrast them, so you go first.
Well, yeah, just like how we think about those first six episodes of season three as a chunk. I think it's useful to think of these eight episodes. That's all. What were you going to say?
I was saying like the first part of the season reads to me is like, we know where we're going. We're going to set off on this confident foot. All the things you brought up in the calm about how this is like kind of a different sort of episode. And then like halfway through, it's not that it feels rushed, but things happen like suddenly a gun magically can't shoot Michael off the island, you know, just like tiny things where you could see like the little wear. But as what's a great thing about doing a Lost Rewatch podcast, we love talking about how these creatives kind of have to riff their way through real life things and then also mistakes they make in their own show. So season four, man, it's not on the bottom list of any of our seasons.
No. Neil, what do you think of like the ultimate combination pack of the Oceanic Six that we get?
I mean, I think it's a fun sort of mystery, for the audience to sort of, you know, try and unpack what are they lying about. I don't know. I mean, I reserve the right to evaluate that a little bit more when we get to the end. It's funny. I was watching today a couple of clips ahead in season four, and I caught the scene where the Oceanic Six finally come home, you know, and you see them land on the airplane, you see their family show up, and it's really fascinating that I actually don't know where I was going with that. I'm sorry.
that scene always makes you really emotional because Saeed doesn't have anyone, and then
Hurley's like, hug my family.
Hug my family. But yeah, I think it's so tricksy and interesting. The whole Aaron thing is so tricksy and interesting. Right?
It wasn't Aaron's the weird one.
It wasn't until this podcast recording that I realized I wanted it to be Vincent. And I was like, if you're gonna do a dirty trick like that, why not get Vincent off the island?
I will say this, the thing that stuck with me more in my, you know, back in the day when it was airing, the more profound moment to me was Sawyer's jumping off of the helicopter. Leaping off. I don't remember caring that much about the mystery around the Oceanic Six. As far as like who they were, I don't remember being as into that.
Well,
it was more about what happened to the people they left behind at that point.
It's true because we know all of them by episode 4, right? Mm-hmm. Gion. Yeah, of course. Because there's a question. That's what they do. They're so clever, right? Like Desmond gets off the island but isn't part of the Oceanic Six, so that complicates the math. And then you're not sure if Aaron counts because he's a baby.
And Gion's the whole trick episode.
So you think that like maybe there are two slots left of maybe Sun and Jin. So I guess when Aaron shows up, we're going to have to like pretend that there still could be two more adults that make it off. You know what I mean? But yeah, like the tension then becomes... So Gion is like episode 7. So by episode 7, we know everyone who made it off. So then, yeah, the question is, how did the people who didn't make it off not make it off? And it's still a really interesting shell game. Because even when you know all the Oceanic Six, you're like, wait, but Saeed's all the way across the island over there. Or no, Saeed's out on the freighter. Kate's all the way over there. Like, how are they going to do this? You know what I mean? The answer is a helicopter. Answer is a helicopter.
The answer is Frank Lapidus.
Frank Lapidus. That's the answer to every question of how someone gets off the island. It's Frank Lapidus. He's the only person who could get anyone off the island with any certainty. All right, guys. I think we're off and running for season 4. Interesting note that I looking at our schedule, if everything goes as planned, we'll do our season 4 finale episode the last week of the year and then start 2021, assuming there is a 2021, with season 5, and it will be fantastic. But until then...
Wait, what's our post-election one? Is it the Constant?
The Constant is the week after the election.
Yeah. So either we're going to like really need... We might need to cry either way, is how I feel about it, right? So, yeah.
I mean, the Constant episode is going to be interesting because we will be recording that while democracy happens and then release it while we still don't know how democracy worked out, probably. And then, you know, maybe do an episode the next week. Either way, what's up with the rest of your 2020? We don't know, but you could count on one thing. The three of us talking about season 4 of Lost. It's happening on the storm. Welcome to season 4. Neil, what are you... hosting a live watch of this weekend, and we are talking about next week.
Oh, well, we're getting into Confirmed Dead, which I believe refers to all the people on the plane who died.
Yep.
It's the science team. It's a flashback for...
I love that it says that in parentheses.
Yeah,
it's like
the freighter crew. So we'll get to know...
Tasty Dan Faraday tears to start us off.
We get to know Dan Faraday's name, and we'll move on from there.
It's a step in the right direction.
Until then, where can people find more of your work online, Neil?
Well, you can always get some stuff that I do over at filmschoolrejects.com, or follow me on Twitter at Rejects or at One Perfect Shot. That's another one that I do. And don't forget to follow our show at Storm Podcasts, where you can vote in polls and all kinds of fun stuff.
And Joanna Robinson.
Oh, you can find me on vanityfair.com. You can hear me talking about things and stuff on various podcasts, such as Little Gold Men, where this week we talked about Trial of Chicago 7, American Utopia, and what the Constitution means to me. Still watching, where this week I will be discussing the latest episode of We Are Who We Are from HBO, and also a special bonus episode with Anthony Breskin talking about The Haunting of Bly Manor. So, you know, good stuff. Or on Twitter at Joe Wrote This, if I didn't already say that.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You could follow me on Twitter, but don't. And I'm at polygon.com, where I, wrote up the Lost panel from last week's New York Comic Con, so you could check me out there. And I'm also on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, where this week we discuss the news that Disney is pivoting its business towards streaming. And outside of saying the corporations are bad, I actually have some interesting thoughts about where that could go. So check that out wherever fantastic podcasts are found. And as always, I'll be here every week talking about Lost and urging you to stay safe, stay healthy, and do not fall down.